name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. In this episode, we speak with the founder of Recruit for Spouses. We talk about her early life in Wales, a near-death experience as a child, and the domestic abuse that shattered her confidence and identity. We also speak about building a successful business, being vision-led, and the strength taught to her by her dad. Episode 50, Helleth Kendrick. This is Declassified. Born in Pembrokeshire.
Born in Pembrokeshire, beautiful part of West Wales, and had a wonderful childhood. I was very lucky, actually. We had a little house. Mum and Dad had a house up on the hill, which you overlooked the sea. And we had ponies, and Dad worked for himself. He had a removals business, and Mum was a teacher. And we had great summers and cycling and doing all sorts of things outside. And it was just wonderful, really. And my grandparents lived locally. And just couldn't fault it, really. Had a brother, sister. So I was very, very lucky. And only until I moved away did I realise how lucky I was, really, to have.
And the community in there, what was it? Were you in a village, a town?
So we lived in it's a place called Goodick, actually, which is where the ferry leaves for Ireland. So it was a tiny little village. It was like a village, really, a town, small town. Had a couple of shops, but that was it, really. So nothing untoward, one little primary school and a big secondary school. But yeah, it was a small village. So it was just a really lovely childhood. I was very lucky. Mm.
Was income coming in? Did you have money? Was it middle class?
Until not loads of money. We had enough to survive, but until the recession hit in the 80s and it really got bad then and things started to get really hard for Mum and Dad. Dad lost his business eventually. But then I was kind of teenager and planning to leave home, and I had this huge, you know, just wanted to leave home when I was sort of 15, 16. So yeah, that's what I wanted to do.
Well, was it because it was like a small town? Did you have a loving parent?
Yeah, my dad was the best dad you could ever ask for. But I was very sick when I was 12, and it's not really my story, but I had meningitis when I was 12, and I was very, very lucky to survive. And then I developed encephalitis after that. So my 12, 13, I was very, very, very tired, lots of headaches, really struggled in school. But also, I remember when I came out of my coma, the nurse saying to me, "You're very lucky to be alive." And ever since then, I've always sort of lived with my foot full on the gas, really.
So you weren't planning to run away, you were planning to go and live.
Yeah, I just wanted to see the world, and I felt that it was a small town and there was nothing really going on there. I just wanted to see the world, and I really wanted to ride. I loved riding horses, and Mum and Dad couldn't really afford to, you know, for me to ride. So I thought I'll work my way up to as far as I can.
Before we move on there, when did your dad lose his business? How old was you, roughly?
Probably late 80s. So he hung on till the early 90s, really, but it started to get pretty bad in the early 90s. So he was very distracted, very, working all hours to keep it going. And it was just, not really going anywhere.
What did your mum and dad split up?
Yeah, mum and dad split up then when I was in my later 20s, when I'd left home. Okay. So yeah.
That's okay. So it was a stable childhood.
Yeah, it was great childhood until later on.
Talk about meningitis. Do you remember kind of the build up to it?
Yeah, I was 12. I think I was 12 at the time, but I remember having a headache, quite a bad headache, and then went to bed. And I remember it really well because I just remember this feeling that it just felt my head was being cut in half, literally. Really bad hallucinations, and I lost. Yeah, I started to get paralysed from my feet, my arms, hands. Couldn't eat, drink. Luckily for me, I mean, the first doctor that came around said I had a flu and just to give me a paracetamol and go to bed. But by some chance, my mum just decided that it wasn't right. And she was on the phone to a friend, I think. And they took out another doctor, and the doctor took one look at me and said, "Get her now into hospital." There wasn't any ambulances available. It was still the same case in NHS Wales now. But my dad picked me up. I remember him picking me up. And I had a phobia. You get a phobia against light. So any light that you see, you just get this slicing pain through your head. And I was minutes away from death, really. So Dad picked me up. I was screaming in pain. I remember the pain unbelievable, really. I do remember that. And then I went into a coma. I went into, obviously don't remember what happened, but I do remember people talking to you when you're in a coma. I remember that. I remember,
really? Yeah,
my family around me and crying.
So your dad literally picked you up?
He picked me up and put me in the back of his car because I was dying, basically. And he just drove. It was about a 20, I think it's a 25-minute trip, and I think it took him 5 minutes. So that's what he did. I don't remember much after. I just remember that nurse and the recovery. The recovery took a while. I remember my legs being really wobbly, and I remember not being able to remember how to do things like make a cup of tea and trying to hide it from my family, because you could see everybody was so worried, and not knowing who people were and being quite confused a lot of the time. So it was just a really strange time for me. Really.
Confused because she was in the hospital, or confused because of the meningitis?
I think the illness just made me very confused, just basic things that, like, you know, where things were in the house, I didn't know where they were. It just it's a disease of the brain. So, and then once the encephalitis developed as well, which is a swelling on the brain as well, that kind of made my cognitive decision-making and just day-to-day stuff quite hard, you know. So I had to work really hard as an adult to remember stuff and, yeah, to be better at what I do.
And then, so that's 12, 13, mm-hmm. Age group, especially for a young girl.
Yeah.
Schooling mixed with your passion for horses.
Mm-hmm.
Where was the balance there then? Were you able to ride? To get your schooling sorted?
Well, schooling was tough. I was bullied quite badly as a result, because I think I was just not normal for a while. I think, all I wanted to do was live. I wanted to go out and live. I wanted to make the most of life. I wanted to get school over and done with. I found school quite boring. I didn't enjoy it. I didn't. The teachers weren't very nice. You know, back in the day, in the 80s, our teachers were, I mean, not, you can get it much worse, you know, now, but smoking fags in the back of the classroom and having whiskey was the kind of normal schooling for me. a teacher used to throw chalk things at the kids. And yeah, it wasn't a very nice school. And when I got my GCSEs, it was quite a bad day for me. But it was, yeah.
Did you get anything?
Nothing. I did try. That's the thing. I think I tried, and that was the first sort of assault on my confidence, really, because I was trying really hard, and I was doing really well in school until I got sick, and then it was all downhill. But yeah, he was reading out my results, and he basically said that I was a disgrace to school, and that I should maybe go and work in a chip shop in Merthyr. Oh, he did actually suggest I drive trucks at the army, and I was like, no way, I'm not joining the army. he was reading out my results, and it sounded like he's spelling out a swear word with F-U-C and all those sort of things. It was not good, but yeah.
This is a direct impact of...
Well, I mean,
meningitis.
You could have said that. I mean, I think, yeah, it was really hard for me to retain information. I mean, still today, I will ask somebody the same question 10 times, but that's because I have to have that full 360. But it's given me a really different ability to see things differently. I see things so differently to what, and it was, if anything, it was a gift really now, because the way I think is, I think differently to most people, I think. And I take more risk for sure.
I left with one GCSE, so this is like
the thickest podcast ever.
Let's talk about the leaving then. Again, it wasn't an escape, it was more of a pursuit of adventure. You went to Canada. How old was you?
I was 17. I mean, I didn't have any qualifications, I went to Jersey. I think I got went to college in Carmarthen, which was interesting, which was another bizarre place in Wales. But then I went to Jersey for a few months, and then I wanted to go to Canada. I worked in England, in Surrey, for a short while, working for a well-known horsey person, but that was awful. I mean, I was on £10 a week. And I was working 7 days a week and I had Sunday afternoons off, and I was most part of a year being absolutely, I've never been so tired in my life. And I did all the work, but I was so keen, you know, I wanted to just be this rider. I was never allowed near the horses. I was never allowed to work. So I remember reading an article, and it was obviously the day for the internet back in the day. And I wrote to the Canadian Olympic team because I thought, I really want to work in Canada because it's different. And I wrote this letter, and about 3 weeks later, I get this letter back from this lady saying, yeah, we've got your job. So I borrowed I have £320 off my dad, and I went to Canada. And I worked for the Canadian Olympic team over there, and I stayed there for 5 years, and I absolutely loved it. And I traveled, I mean, I passed my driving test at 17 in Wales, where there were no roundabouts and no traffic lights. No dual carriageway. And I was so chuffed. And I got to Canada and they said, yeah, you're driving. You got a driving license? Yeah, yeah, I got a driving license. And they said, right, you're driving from Toronto to Vancouver. And I was like, great. I looked at the map and I saw it's just a few hours. It took me 4 days and I had kind of the person with me. And then I got hooked and I basically helped transport horses around America and Canada. And I'd pick up random people but people I knew that were safe, and we would drive. So I drove basically the square of America and Canada, which took a long time. So I went from Toronto down to Seattle, down to Canada, to California, across the desert. So I did the sort of road trip with six horses, dropping off horses, picking them up. Mm. You can imagine the breakdowns and the, you know, and then I went up to Kentucky, Atlanta.
What, horse racing horses?
No, they were 3 day event, right, horses.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So they were 3 day eventers at the time, yeah.
And so that role was, you was like a courier for horses?
Yeah, I had a work visa, so I was kind of stopping and working. I did a really stupid thing. I'd promised my mum that I was going to come back and do a sort of a college course, and I bought a horse. I bought a horse and it was $1,200. And I didn't have a bridle, didn't have a saddle, didn't have anything, but I worked to get the saddle, I worked to get the bridle, I worked to get everything. And I eventually competed the horse, and I used to hitch. So I'd phone up people because of, you know, are you on Highway 302 on this day? And I basically went around America and Canada competing this horse and sold him for $10,000. I was like, I felt so rich. That was the hardest day because me and this horse had travelled around the world, and not the world, but America and Canada together. Yeah. But I sold him to a rich New York banker. And that's funded me then to go to New Zealand and Australia. And I worked for the team in New Zealand as well.
So all this time, it's working with
horses. With 3 day event horses, yeah.
But with an aim to what, working for Olympic teams?
Yeah, I was. So in Canada, I did. My decision was I enjoyed the kind of back office stuff. So looking after the horses at base, which meant I lived in North Canada in the winter. So it's minus 45, and I've never experienced cold like that. And it was unbelievable. And that's quite character building. And so we had, you know, there was me, and we lived in as they call them, trailers, a big static caravan effectively, which was essentially covered in snow because we had so much snow for best part of 6-7 months of the year in the north of Canada. But it was great, and yeah, learned a lot. But then in the spring, then we transport the horses south and sell them. And
what were you doing? Were you training?
Horses and selling. So the owners would ask us to transport these horses to these locations, and we would do that. And then they would,
How does it work then? Is there like a central area, like a centre, I suppose, and then people bring in their own horses and they pay you to train them?
So I worked at a base that had horses, and they were young horses, and these horses would then go south to be sold Americans, Canadians, whatever. A lot of the Canadians went south for the competition circuit, but I was silly enough to stay in the north with the horses that weren't sold. And then that's when I decided to drive them down, and that's when we
And then you mentioned New Zealand and Australia.
Yeah.
Was that more of the same?
Yeah, no, well, New Zealand was different. I then decided that I really did want to compete. And then I went to New Zealand and worked in show jumping and spent my first 6 months falling off every day. And then worked for the New Zealand team in New Zealand and came back to the UK then. In would have been 1996, and came back and worked for the New Zealand team over here before they did Atlanta and Sydney in 2000.
This was a passion, was it? This was
I was just, I loved riding horses, and I just loved the whole, just everything about it, really. And I wasn't very good at it. I mean, I got semi-professional, but I didn't really get to the point where I was good enough. And I was falling off all the time, so I just had to hang up my boots. And then I went into racing, horse racing, and I trained to be a journalist. And that's how I did, I got to sort of 30, and realised I had to get a career, really. So I trained to be an editor, and I've always wanted to write. So I was editor for a couple of horse magazines.
In the UK?
In the UK, yeah.
You know, relationships-wise now, age 24, you got into a relationship. Whereabouts was that? Were you in Wales?
No, so I was in the UK. I came back to the Cotswolds and started working with horses in the Cotswolds, met somebody, moved in with him. He was working in London, actually. And I just was a groom working again. So I was working with racehorses at that time, a bit with eventing. So I was doing a lot of different things and doing training to be a writer, so trying to better myself and do something. So yeah, and I did, and I really enjoyed that element of, I sort of slowly coming to the realization that horse riding wasn't going to be my future, and that I needed to do something which is going to be a bit more, whether I get qualifications or do something. So that's why I decided to go into writing.
But the relationship, when you use 24, 10 year relationship with someone,
yeah,
did it start out good?
Talking about myself is so hard. It was okay, but mum and dad were divorcing, so he was somebody, and I suppose I did want to settle down and get married and have kids, I suppose, at 24. But he was charming, he was funny, and he was okay. But the longer we were together, the more I realised, I mean, as soon as we moved in together, I thought, oh, this isn't right, I need to get out. But I didn't really have much. You don't really earn much money in the horsey world. He was quite controlling, quite coercive with his control, financially, emotionally and everything. And I think it just slowly sort of, it's like a sort of rot, really. It rots in. But you know, I was really young, and I didn't know what I was doing. And confidence is a big thing with me. I think I've always lacked in confidence and believing in myself. And my dad was such a nice man. He was a good dad. He was a good man. And I always thought that I was lucky to grow up with amazing uncles. And I thought that every man was like that. And he wasn't. And he wasn't. This chap I was with wasn't very kind. He obviously had his own issues. And luckily, I got out of that relationship.
Well, before that, what kind of controlling behaviour did he have to you?
Awful. It was really bad, in the sense that we would go on very nice holidays and he would just restrict my money and controlling. And it was his insecurities at the end of the day. But because I was always giving him the benefit of the doubt, and I thought, oh, you know, it's okay, it's not that bad. And we were living together, and he'd do something really lovely, and every Christmas, not that I'm materialistic at all, get all the sort of nice presents and stuff, which you stay and you think, gosh, I need to stay in this relationship. I got to work at this. And he made me think it was me. So I was the one at fault. It was my fault that, you know, he wanted the house a certain way. He wanted everything his way. I felt it was me. It was always blamed that it's your fault. You're the one who's doing it. You're the one who doesn't communicate. You're the one who's... So you think, oh, gosh, it is me. So you become very sort of on edge that, oh, gosh, it is me. And then, you know, the realisation that actually it's not me, and taking the guts to leave is really tough, because financially he had controlled me completely. So that was hard.
So you talked about like gifts and things. Was the praise important?
Yeah, I wouldn't say praise important, but I just felt that I had a champion. I mean, my dad was a huge believer in me, but dad obviously was going through his own stuff. And I felt I didn't have that support. So I just needed somebody that was, and he did. He kind of let me believe that. It's so hard to talk about myself, but yeah, he just let me
ask you a specific question then. So day to day, you talk about, and again, this has crept in over a period of time, but what and you're reflecting back now, what was happening during the day that now as in a healthy relationship, older, looking back at your 28-year-old self, let's say, mm-hmm. What would you see that was not right?
That I didn't believe and I didn't have the confidence to just walk away. So many times it said, just leave, just go, just walk away. And I didn't.
But what would he be doing to you on a daily basis? Is it words?
You're stupid, you're thick, you're nothing without me. You have no qualifications, you can't do this. And then on the good days, it would be, oh, no, you're amazing, you're great. You know, let's do this together, we can do this. I'll help you to get to where you need to get to. Yes, of course, you can do this. But other times, you know, you're not, you know, you're ugly, you're fat, you need to lose weight, all that sort of stuff. And don't wear that, you know, and it just kind of gets.
What about your friends? Was there any
friends
restriction
again,
friends?
Only my friends that I've got a friend called Elaine, who's been my best friend since I was three. she's still my friend now. And they just stood by and watched and they couldn't say anything. My family couldn't say anything. My grandparents at the time, my grandmother at the time, everybody was, they said they lost me, essentially. They lost me totally as a person.
So your hobbies were going as well?
Everything left, everything went. The ambition, the drive that I had was just gone, but it was all about him and controlling, making sure that he was okay and he was happy and that he was, you know, everything that was around what he needed.
Should your family have said something?
They did try many times, but I felt sorry for him. I felt that he had, you know, he had Asperger's, so he was, there was elements of his personality that were very good and caring, but yeah. Mm.
You left that relationship.
Yeah.
And I suppose a rebound relationship. You fell pregnant.
Yeah. Oh, this is really...
That relationship then was short, but again, quite abusive.
Yeah, and again, I think people probably think, what an idiot. Why would you do such a stupid thing? But again, you could say it's confidence and everything, but I always try and see the good in people and see the right thing. And not that I felt sorry for him, but I fell pregnant, my fault. But I always say that my daughter's the best mistake I ever made. And as soon as I was pregnant, I thought, this isn't right. I've got to get out of this. This is awful. And moved to Wales with my dad. I moved in with my dad. I turned up on his doorstep with my Astra, Vauxhall Astra, full of two dogs and everything I owned. And I was 5 months pregnant. And I said, Dad, I've messed up. He said, it's all right, love. He said, come in, have a cup of tea. And I felt like I'd really... And meanwhile, I knew that was getting married and getting engaged and having all the right, you know, and I thought, I should have stayed with that first guy. I should have done that. Everything that he was saying to me, I think he'd put me to such a point that I didn't feel that I was worthy. I wasn't, you know, I couldn't achieve anything and everything was going wrong. My work, I was trying really hard and it was tough. But and I was working hard, but just trying to make ends meet really, and then fell pregnant and I thought, oh no, what have I done now?
Why did you go back to your dad?
Because I was not safe where I was in the Cotswolds with him around. I wasn't safe and I knew that...
Physically.
Yeah. I knew that he wasn't right. And I had to get as far away as I could. So I moved in with my dad. I left my lovely little cottage in the Cotswolds that I was hiring, was renting. I loved that little place, but I had to leave. And I was right. I was absolutely right about him. He was dangerous and crazy. Mm. So,
And then you had your daughter.
Yeah.
Who was with you when...
So he wanted to be at the birth and again, my friend Elaine was there and she said, please just let me be there because we don't want him there. And I said, no, it's fine. He can be, he's the father, he can be there. And he was, as I was having a C-section, he was texting and his new woman. And I just remember the phone beeping and I was like, oh, you know. And then she was born And I remember that moment when I held a Derwent in my hands and I just thought, oh my gosh, you know, they talk about this surge of love and I'm not very maternal. And I just remember looking at this little person thinking, I have got to make her world brilliant. I've got whatever I'm going to do. I'm going to just do everything for this child. I'm going to make it. I'm going to make things right for her. And she was beautiful. And, you know, my dad came in and there was a child opposite, and Dad always used to say really embarrassing things. And he said to the girl opposite, who had a little boy and his face was all squished up, and he said, well, you know, you've still got to take them home at the end of the day, you know. And he looked at Darren and he just like beaming, you know, she was just so beautiful. And I just remember everything else didn't matter. And I just thought, I've got to make this work. And, you know, I was going to go back to college and I was going to get a degree and I was going to get myself sorted, you know, everything just sorted out. And I wasn't gonna, you know, no men, that was it. I was just gonna focus on me. So I had a job, I went out and got a job.
When she was little?
Well, so I was pregnant and I worked when I was pregnant.
Yeah.
And then I didn't have maternity. I couldn't afford it, really. So I went to work for Racehorse Trainers, a PA really. And they were great, amazing in Wales. Peter Bowen and his wife, they were huge support to me. I worked since Darren was a week old. I had to work. So I was just, and I was actually a bit bored. But I'd put her in a little thing and she'd come to work with me and I'd do my work and that was it. But it was, I was actually driving as well, but I had to. I living on my own in a cottage in Wales, in the middle of nowhere, I had to work.
Was you vulnerable, exposed in a cottage in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah, and that's what happened when I deliberately chose to live. I remember when I was pregnant, turning up to the job centre and saying, "I need a job, and I need to work." And they said, "Well, we can put you in a council flat in Pembroke Dock." And I remember thinking, "No, I'm not going to bring my daughter up." And I don't mean to sound a snob, but I just wanted the best for her.
Yeah.
I said, no, I'll rent a cottage. So I did a lot of sort of writing work and was writing copy for websites. Can you believe that? I could never do that now. And got enough money together to have a deposit for this cottage, and then lived in this little Welsh cottage in the middle of nowhere. It was pitch black, but it was so beautiful and it was my space. But sadly, when Adair was 3 weeks old, I was breastfeeding her one night and I was texting a friend in the old, you know, dial phones you have, and I heard a car coming down the driveway, which never heard a driver, and I thought, oh my gosh. And he'd always, my daughter's father had always said, I'll find out where you live and when she's born I'll come and I'll see her. And I said, well, no you won't. And he'd got a lift to Pembrokeshire, gone out to a pub, got very, very drunk and said to the guys in the pub, oh, was it, you know, and everybody knows everybody in Pembrokeshire. It's like, you know, and he'd managed to find out where I lived and he tracked me down and he turned up to my house at about 3 o'clock in the morning when I was breastfeeding her at three in the morning, you know, three in the morning. She was 3 weeks old, three threes. And he broke into my house and I remember texting my friend saying, can you please just phone the police now. And my friend Bessa at the time, she was in Burford and she was said she was shaking. She knew that he was dangerous because that's why I'd moved away. And she said she talked the police in. But in that time he had sat on my bed and basically said, I'm going to kill you. You've ruined my life. And he proceeded to punch me, jump on me. I was still breastfeeding her. He hit me in the head. And I just remember, I don't really know what really happened, but he kept saying, you ruin my life, you ruin everybody's life. And I was like, why does this always happen to me? Why does it? I remember thinking, why me, you know? And just fighting him off.
And where was your daughter?
I was still feeding her at the time. Mm. And I remember him, you know, kicking it, you know, just literally, I ended up, he was on the floor and I was on top of him and I was pulling, I was like, just get up, pulling him off, you know, me. And then luckily the police turned up. And I remember just saying to him, just get him out, just I want him out. And they said, do you want us to press charges? I said, I don't care. I said, just get him out of my house. And the whole house is wrecked, totally wrecked. And the police were amazing. They were incredible. And I hadn't really seen him since of that. He did see his daughter through a contact centre because the police said that he was dangerous and they didn't really want him to have that contact with her. And then when she was about five, she'd get in the car, and when she started to speak, she said, "Mummy doesn't, I don't want to see him anymore." And I never would say anything negative about him, but she got in the car one day and she looked at me and she just threw up, and she was so nervous,
oh my
I think.
God.
And the contact centre actually said, "We're going to stop this meeting because he's not very nice to her. He keeps trying to get her to bring different girlfriends along every time." And, you know, so they made the decision then. And I felt really embarrassed because I brought my family into this. I'd, you know, again, made a stupid mistake. And yeah, so yeah, it's just one of those things.
You know, we live in, thankfully, we live and learn, you know.
Yeah, and, yeah, you do.
And these things happen, but what you didn't do is you didn't let it prolong. You didn't suffer this for a lot of prolonged time. You had the strength, you know. You even in that conversation, you know, you're blaming. You're good. You can. I've known you for several years. Like we're friends.
Yeah.
But even in that conversation, you're going back to what you did wrong. You did nothing wrong.
Yeah. No.
You was putting the two people did something. Did yeah, something to you, and you had the guts, and you had the.
Yeah, I just thought that, you know, all men were good. Silly, really thing, and to think, but.
Well, thankfully, you did meet a good.
Yeah.
Man, and it was actually it was about a year later. Is that right?
So his mother was Darren's childminder. So she was, and he just got back from Afghanistan, and I remember he was sitting in the living room at the time. And
so this is Neil.
This is Neil, my husband. Yeah, bless him. He did say, "Don't mention me on the podcast. Don't mention me." I was like, "Okay, no, I won't worry." I remember meeting, I think, "Oh my gosh, he's a soldier. There's no, I'm definitely not going there because army is great, but I'm not going to go from the frying pan to the fire. Now I've had two really bad relationships. The soldier is definitely not the way. I'm not marrying anybody, not getting involved with anybody." But he just, I think he was going out to Afghanistan, literally. And we started emailing and chatting, and yeah, we just hit it off. We were just, he was such a great guy, and he was intelligent, he was funny, he was brilliant, and we just hit it off. And he was so kind. We got back, he got back from Afghanistan, and we went on a few dates, and that was it really. And we just, yeah, that's how we sort of fell in love really. And that's how he was such a great guy. And was so good with Darren. He was just, he's never to this day said she's your daughter. He's treated her like his own. Mm. So yeah, he was great for that, really. Mm. I admire him for that, actually, because it's not easy to meet a mum, young mum. I was pretty much broken. So he picked me off the floor, and he was great. Great support to me.
Well, that's proof, you know, people. You know, you can make a few bad decisions, but when you get the good one. And then you had a baby boy.
Harry, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
So that's 2009.
Yeah.
Let's fast forward a little bit, or let's bridge this gap. So 2008, 2009, between that period, so you're now in brackets, an army wife, right?
Yeah.
What was you seeing? Because you're in your mid-30s now as well at this point.
Yeah.
What were you seeing with regards to employment opportunities with the military spouses in brackets?
Well, I mean, I was amazed. I mean, I came into this world, I was kind of catapulted into this world of the military. And first of all, I thought, wow, it's a house with heating and it's just incredible. I was just in awe of... and when I had Harry, I was what a lady called Jules, actually, she knocked on my door and said, "I've just arranged, I'm your neighbour," she said, "and all of us are going to cook you a meal for the next, you know," I think it was a month or something. And for the next, every day for the next month, I had a meal delivered every evening to my door by a military spouse. And they were spouses who were husbands in the Navy, they were in Afghanistan at the time, they were... had little children, and sometimes it was a ready meal, sometimes it was a meal that they'd made, and they'd had bottles of beer for Neil, you know, wine for me. But I just remember that time thinking, oh my gosh, you know, these people that are complete strangers that have husbands that are on tour with little children have all got together, they don't know who I am, and they've made me a meal every night. And it was just so lovely. And I just never forget that. So obviously the conversation to start and I like, what do you do? And not one of them works. And the conversation always went to their what they did, or, you know, you go to these dinner nights and it's very much about the husband and what they do in their career, which is great. But when you started talking to the wives, the spouses, the partners, you know, you start unfolding. So I just, when Harry was in his little papoose and Adair was in her thing, I'd walk around and I thought, oh, I've got nothing better to do. And I just would knock on their door and say, can you tell me your story? And they'd say, oh gosh, I was a doctor, I was a surgeon, I was a scientist, I was a teacher, I was a midwife, I was a journalist, I was an editor. And I was like, oh my gosh, all these people that, and they said, but we'll never be able to work it. Forget your career now. You may as well hang it up, hang up your boots. And I just remember feeling that, thinking it was desperately unfair. So I best spent about of 2 years researching really what was available and what was out there, because I had nothing else to do. And actually, the great thing about being a military spouse is that you don't pay. The military does actually really look after you. You know, you have a home, a roof over your head, and it's an opportunity really for spouses to start a career. You know, you do need to work, but there's that, when you've got young children, there's that time that you have that you can have a bit of a career break, and it gives you an opportunity to think. So I did, and I phoned every single military charity. I think some were like, oh God, here she goes again. And it was the same guy a few times and laughing at me. And I said, oh, my name is Helen Welsh. And I, you know, I'm going to start. Is there anywhere for spouses to go if they want to work? No spouse works. We don't work. You know, why would they can't work unless you're a teacher or a nurse or something. I'm like, well, yeah, but there's nothing here. There's no advice. There's nothing really to support them. No. And that's actually the time I met Louise at Little Troopers, because she was doing the same for kids with Little Troopers. We were on the phone laughing about starting up. And so I decided at that point to be a social enterprise, a business, not a charity, because I felt there was, at the time, about 2,000 military charities, and there was Help for Heroes, and there was all these really great things going on. And the Military Wives Choir, I do remember standing in front of VCAB, Executive Committee of the Army Board, after I'd launched the business, and them asking me, what on earth was I doing? And I was like, well, you know, I got this really good idea, and it's, you know, going to help all these wives into work, and husbands as well. And they're like, you can't do this. You know, it's not goodwill. You're not a charity. I said, but we're not charity. We're not pity. Don't feel sorry for us. We don't want to be patronised or pitied. We want to be...
Why would a doctor or a lawyer or someone who is in admin and loves it, or a childminder and whatever it is, why would they then settle for not having a career and becoming a wife or a husband of
someone? It's like anything. You meet your partner, you fall in love, and you think, right, that's it. I'm going to give it a go. I'm going to keep my... And I'm still to this day meeting spouses now who just got married. Actually, funnily enough, I met a spouse the other day, and it was great because she was telling me about the time when she got married. She got a really good company. She's doing really well. And she knew nothing about recruiting spouses. And I remember thinking, that I've done, my job is done, you know, because she didn't know about us. And actually, it was because her job, she's able to work from home. She's able to have a career. She can do all of those things now because the MOD is so much more behind it now and understand it now.
And it's also worth saying that because, you know, men predominantly have these careers, not wholly, women as well, have these military careers, and they do move around, and that's the way it is. It's the nature of the beast. And that's, again, that's why people predominantly women will sacrifice potentially a career for a prolonged period of time.
Well, they have the children, don't they? So it's easier for them. And in the dual-serving partnerships, I mean, I really have huge admiration for the ones that are dual-serving and have children. There's so many things that affect a military family now. There's so many different things. And I think for dual-serving couple, it's very difficult if they've got children.
So you started, or that seed was planted in 2011. You launched early 2012. Did it get a good reception?
Amazing. I mean, to be honest, it's all such a blur, really, because it all happened so quickly. But I remember launching the website, and we had a launch party at one of the clubs in London, Union Jack Club. And we had 12,000 hits on our website within, you know, and we had, I think it was like 1,500 spouses register. And then we got a lot of press. We got a lot of interest because it was obviously just Afghanistan was in the news a lot and they wanted a positive story. So we were on the PM show, Eddie Mair. And I remember being a bit like, I'm sitting in front of you now and you're a friend and it's so much easier. I've done so much more radio work. But that time, and there's Caroline Wyatt and Eddie Mair and Radio 4. And I remember being terrified and thinking, oh my gosh. And we had something like three, I mean, I think it's like, the number three keeps coming up. It's funny because we did have like over 3,500 hits on our website in about 5 minutes and it crashed our website. And we had all these emails from women, and mainly women, all over the country that had given up their jobs, retired, saying, you know, I was in Ireland, Northern Ireland, I was in the Falklands, I was a teacher. My gosh, we needed this in the 80s. Or so many stories of people saying, gosh, we needed this. We tried, but we failed and we just wanted to work. We missed working, I missed teaching. And actually, when I was doing my research, there was some, there was a bit of a paper cutting I found from the First World War, when they said that they asked that the wives of the Toms found something to do whilst they were away because they needed to be distracted and they needed to have a job, and actually could, was there anything that they could do? I think it was one of the military charities. So, and it's a really good, when your husband is away or on deployment, working is such a good distraction. I mean, we need to work. We all need to work.
Well, we need purpose and meaning. We need we're contributing. So, yeah. This is, you know, and you look at this from a well-being point of view. And I sort of apologies for interrupting, but well-being, performance, not just a male issue.
Exactly.
You know, men's mental health isn't just a male issue. Women's mental health isn't just a women's issue. You know, we're human beings and you need certain things to fulfill that. And and quite often having something that's purpose-driven is one of them.
Yeah. And there are so many barriers to entry for a spouse to work still to this day. I mean, it is so hard. And we, with our Career Academy now, we're seeing hundreds of spouses that we have to put in our Career Academy to build up their confidence. Confidence is something that keeps recurring. And I say to my team now, you know, don't ever forget what it's like to be that spouse sitting on the sofa thinking, oh my gosh, what do I do now? How do I get a job? Where do I go? I can't just go to a job centre. I don't have a car. We only have one laptop. And there's all these things. Oh, my children, Johnny just started school. I've got to make sure he's okay. Or husband's about to be going on a course. And there's so many barriers for a spouse just on a daily basis. And that's why it's really important to keep
So 2012, what was Recruit for Spouses then? What was the social pitch? What was that?
So it was like, we'll help with your CV, get wives back into work. We're here to help. We had a couple of contacts, but there were so many. I'd never run a business before, so I wasn't really sure what I was doing. And it was very much around, I just needed to get something. I mean, I put something on the Angel Network because I knew I needed £5,000. I had to borrow £100 to start the business. So I put something on the Angel Network and this chap came back and he said, I'll invest. And I said, great. I need £5,000 for a website. And he goes, oh, I'll give you 10. I was like, what? Yeah. And he said, give me your bank details. And it was like, is this right in it? And his name was Palmer. And he was serving in Afghanistan at the time. His dad didn't know that, but he came back. And I remember him sitting in my living room and I was like, he was 24 years of age at the time. And I was like, Palmer, you gave me £10,000. I don't even know you. I could have just gone off to the Bahamas or something. Why did you do that? And we were laughing about it. And he still to this day owns part of the company. And he said, I was out in Afghanistan with the rifle company. And he said, I went out with 30 and I came back with 5 that weren't injured or killed. And he said, I held the hands of dying men. And the last thing they said was, look after her. God. He said, and out in operations, that's what the wife, the girlfriend, it's family is so important to the guys, women on operations. And that to me was the deciding factor when things got really tough. I always remembered that. I always remembered about those women and men that we lost, but equally over the years, the spouses that have wanted to work. And the best thing that you can do for a woman or a community is to empower them and to find them work. So when the going gets tough, that's what I always thought about.
We look at sustainability as in, you know, and all equally important, you know, the environment or raising people in countries that are developing, but actually sustaining any community is important. Yeah, you need certain
absolutely.
things, and it doesn't matter where that is. You need to be able to provide meaningful employment and safe place to live and
exactly.
et cetera, et cetera.
It's a basic need, isn't it? And I think when you meet, you know, and now, you know, they're meeting, you know, you meet your life partner, whatever, and that person has a career and they have a job, but you take them away from that environment and you're stripping something that there has been part of their core. And that's what we try and do is find that for the spouse again.
I mean, you've won awards and you've been great, especially those early few years. But it always strikes me, there's always someone there to try and take it away.
There's been that a lot. And I think, I don't know why, maybe it's because I'm a bit bumbly and a bit sort of, you know, and I am me. I can't really change. I'm not going to be this big corporate shoulder pads. Mm. Tough. I can be bold, I can be brave, I can be gutsy, and I don't give up, and I can be persistent, but I won't be dishonest. I can't be a bitch. Mm. It's not in my DNA. I've tried, but I just can't. My team will all say that, you know, it's really hard for me to be not very nice. And I just think being kind is a very important thing to be. And as a result of that, I've allowed people into my business over the years that have seen me and thought, well, you know, she's not got the skills or the intelligence, I suppose, to. And I always believed that when somebody would say to me, you know, you're not really that good, are you, Hella? And that echoing of all past
and
things.
That's in what?
2014.
Yeah, people are saying you that.
Yeah, yeah. So we won the Prime Minister's Award. And I had a board of directors and I was very excited and I'll never forget this. And we sat in around a room and we all sat down and I was very excited because we were having a board meeting and I thought, oh, this is great, very grown up. And they basically said, we're going to do a vote. And I said, yeah, okay. And they said, we're going to vote Hella out of the company. And they all put their hands up except for Palmer. He didn't. He said, no, I'm not having her out of this company. This is her business, her idea. But they wanted me out because they basically said I was a figurehead, but I wasn't the right person to run a business. I didn't have the skills. I didn't have the network. I didn't have anything to run a business. And I remember thinking, yeah, well, you are right. But actually, you know, and I just held on. I just, you know, a bit like, you know, Braveheart, just kind of battered the whack-a-mole. I got through it and I made mistakes. And I hold my hands up. I didn't know what a shareholders agreement was. I didn't know what setting up a business was. I didn't know anything about profit and loss balance sheet. I mean, I was literally reading. I mean, the days before really Google, you could Google stuff. So I was in the library trying to understand, and maths obviously wasn't my strongest point, but I've had to get good at it. I've had to learn and I've had to just pull my, you know, socks up and just get on with it, really.
Mm. I think there's definitely, not to talk you through your story, but getting rid of people.
Yeah.
Maintaining the good ones and bringing in new people, not just bringing in for shares, but bringing people into your life that are going to support.
There's
a lot to be said, isn't there?
They see a good thing. And even now, you know, I'm not going to do that with Recruit Spouses because it is, in this essence, we're a purpose-led business and we're doing some great stuff. And there are people that come in and want to buy shares, but they will just you know, deviate it, you know, put those margins up, charge more, pay the spouse less, do this. And it is really hard what we do is to get that balance right. It's really hard. Mm. So, and the spouse is, you know, front and foremost at what we do all the time when I'm out pitching to clients, when I'm, you know, I don't forget that. That's what I live and breathe.
2017.
Mm-hmm.
So I've definitely known you, at least till then, probably 16.
Yeah.
You put a video out that went quite big, didn't it? You got a lot of traction with the video.
Yeah, I mean, we'd had some funding from the MOD in 2016, which was amazing, and it was great. And I was supported by Nick Welsh, actually, who's a great friend of mine and a huge supporter, and he was great, and he did, you know, we had this. We had this funding and it was great because it really put us on a different platform, absolutely did. And then as you know, you've got a team of people and then, you know, it all started to everything just started to break at around 2017, and it was tough. It was getting really, really hard. We weren't really getting any traction with the companies. It was really hard. And actually, the reason it was so hard is because we weren't a recruitment agency, because, you know, a company comes to you, say, right, you're a recruitment agency, right, I need our admin. But what we needed was something that was going to work for spouses, because I've always put the spouses first. And that was my problem, is that I was saying, no, they don't want to work in Tesco's, or they can't do that. Mm. They can't just all be carers. These are, you know, women or men that have amazing skills and they need to be utilized. And I was trying to find a balance, and it was just a scrapping around, trying, and I just couldn't find it. And I went to the MOD and I said, just need you to get behind what I'm doing here, because this is really important. And in all fairness to them, I mean, spouse employment is not an MOD issue. It really isn't. And I don't believe that it's there for the MOD to solve, and neither will they ever solve it, because every day we have to be so agile. We have to change fast all the time. We have to bend like willow. And it is not there for the MOD to solve. And I've said that to them time and time again. But this one particular time, they had said that it didn't really matter, and that the families weren't really a priority for them. And I just remember feeling so enraged. And I think I did phone you up. Mm. A couple of people I phoned up, and they said, whatever you do, don't say anything. Don't, you know, do what the MOD want and just write a report or whatever. Try and get them on side. And I remember thinking, oh, sod it. And I did this video, and I had been upset. And I said, tell me your story. You know, how do you feel? Do you feel that you've given up a lot to be here? Yeah, and we had 33,000 shares, and it went viral, really. And it was an awful video. I still can't watch it to this day. Yeah. I just cringe. But what it did do is made spouses realize that we were there for them. And that was the best decision I ever made, because all of a sudden we just had this huge voice saying, things need to change, fam, everything's coming out, we matter, we really do matter.
Because you had case studies, and just for the record, I didn't tell you to, it wasn't me that told you to.
You did. You said to me, I remember phoning you up, Michael, and saying, oh my God, because they were spouses that were, they were angry, you know, they were like, and they were leaving sort of these little, they said, I can't tell you where I am, but I'm so angry. What if the MOD push out a fam? What if you might make it worse now? And it went, there's this awful moment where it goes really quiet, you know, like, what has she done? You know, what has she done? And I remember that, you know, awful sense, you know, sort of feeling of, but I had to do it. I couldn't not
I said, do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just fucking do it.
It's your fault. But you did, I then phoned you and said, it's getting worse. What do I do? I've got all these 33,000 shares. My video's gone everywhere. It's gone viral. They're sharing it everywhere and putting their own spin on it. Oh my God, they hate me. And you said, do another video. And I was like, are you mad? And I did. And I did it to say, give us case studies. And we did have 850 case studies, which was enough to go back to the MOD.
And there was some quite sensitive stuff in those case studies, weren't they? As in, people were really pouring it out to you.
Hugely. I mean, one of the stories that I, well, not in these cases, but one of the things that happened was a military wife sadly took her life. And I sat next to her at a dinner night once, and she was a nurse. And I remember thinking, you know, when I heard, I thought, oh my gosh, if, and I had a number in my bag, if only I'd have phoned her, if I didn't, you know, but all these little things that happen make you better at what you do. They make you care more. They make you do that, go that little bit further. But yeah, the case studies were, I mean, the people that read them were like, wow, you know, these are women, mainly women, that did the most. And I felt, I had all this information, and I felt a huge responsibility to do the right thing. So we had a meeting with the Secretary of State for Defence at the time, Gavin Williamson, and that's when they commissioned the Salu report to really change the way that families lived and worked. So they did the report around living in their shoes. So that was really good, because what that really did was get people to understand the challenges that faces in the modern army, I think. I'm here just for spouses and for spouse employment. That's what my expertise is now. I've been doing it for 10 years, but all I could see was people were leaving, people weren't happy. I spent time with the submariners, with their wives, and the stuff that they have to go through, you know, they go through weeks and weeks and months without seeing their partner. They have a, you know, 160 words in a telegram. If, you know, some, God forbid, that something awful happens, they can't bring the sub up just to, and all these people go through so much sacrifice. and they just need a bit of support, and they just want to be able to work, you know, so that's what we're here to do. And I felt that at the time the MOD wasn't enabling us to do that. They were stopping us from doing it. They felt that we were more of a thorn in their side than an asset. And I was trying to just change that sort of perception, really.
Mm. And you did a very good job. But things, you know, even in between that and where we're at, where we are right now, you know, things got harder for the business. And I'm kind of summarising here, because I want to take you to 2019, when things started picking up. You know, you brought in something called the liquid workforce.
Yeah, so there's so many people involved, and there's a chap called Steve Leach who works at AMS, and we were at the Deloitte because I was part of the Deloitte Society Partners program, and Deloitte introduced me to AMS.
And who AMS?
Steve Leach.
No, but
so AMS are an RPO, so they're a recruitment organisation, and they basically go in and they manage all the recruitment services for like the banks, HSBC, AMS, Alexander Mann Solutions. Yeah, huge business. They have, I think, 6,000 employees now, so they're a big business. And I realised at the time that whilst we had contracts with BAE Systems, Deloitte, and all those, because the work that we'd done, we weren't actually getting any traction. We weren't getting jobs. And it was my relentless kind of nagging and phoning and persistence that I realised that we needed to kind of have AMS on side. And Steve Leach is great because he saw in me something that needed to change, and he handheld me through the process of, right, we need to do something. And we used to meet for lunch and coffee, and we literally bashed through ideas, and he was scratching his head, and he didn't have to. He was, so, you know, MD, big company, multi, and I think his CEO actually did say to him, "You're spending too much time with recruit spouses now. You need to stop and just leave." And he was persistent. He, you know, he really believed in what we were doing. He's not military, but he really believed in it. And then we came up with, there's another lady called Lisa Forrest. Funny enough, I bumped into her yesterday at AMS. I hadn't seen her for years. And she said, What about the liquid workforce? We tried to do that with students, where they basically train students to be resources. Resource specialists, like recruitment effectively. And they sit, you know, in their dorms and they work in and around. We just give them work and they do it. And Steve Leach is like, yeah, we could train military spouses to do that. So that's essentially where it came from. But I wish I could say it was that easy. It's been really hard to get it right, but only because we've had the buy-in from the top of, you know, AMS. And that only happens, only do we have success within business. The only reason we're successful is because we've had people in Virgin that have really, and AMS have really gone out of their way to support us. But that's not
charity. That's because
they see a value.
Yeah, there's a big asset.
Yeah, yeah.
That then can get filtered in.
But it's not simple. It's so difficult to do. And there's a whole thing around the network, building the confidence. And lo and behold, you'll have a team of 10, and then you'll have deployment. And there's still 10,000. Mm. My understanding is that 10,000 military personnel are away and deployments. So it's really tough to maintain that pipeline and to sort of keep the spouses on a. They haven't worked for so long. They haven't worked for an average, I think, 85% of our spouses haven't worked for over 8 years.
Oh,
so
wow.
That's a huge percent. So that, you know, you think of a lot of them haven't even got LinkedIn. And yet they would have managed a huge office floor years ago. But my God, when you put them into these roles, they're incredible. Mm. And we learn and we garner these skills. People call them soft skills, but actually we call them skills.
Like, well, there's no such thing as a soft skill.
No,
you
exactly.
Have a soft skill.
Exactly. It's a skill. It's adaptability. And you've seen it yourself. And you're a great example of an employer that has tapped into that network and gets what we do.
But because I get a massive benefit out of it.
Yeah, you see the value. And you know, if you phoned up Amy now or one of your team and said, I need, you know that they would go out of their way, and you know they get shit done. They get it done. They know how to get a job done.
Yeah.
They know how to focus. They know how to, we're used to things going wrong. We're used to moving into a house and everything breaking. We're used to, and the husband's away, or moving the kids to schools. We just get things done. And I think there is, there's a military spouse out there who, I can't remember her name, I'm so sorry. But she has said that there's scientific evidence to prove that we are wired stronger because we're constantly having to use that part of our brain where we're learning and we're constantly putting ourselves in not difficult, but challenging situations. Mm. And so therefore we learn so quickly and we learn to adapt really quickly, which is a really good skill that employers recognise, like yourself and AMS and Virgin.
Yeah, I'm the smaller end of the scale compared to...
Yeah, but you're always important.
But and meaningful, you know, like we... it's not about... It's not the me show, but the people we've had from you... I'll get in trouble with the rest of them. But the best, some of the best, yeah. You know, and they are, and you know, we try and, yeah. and work with everybody and, yeah. and be flexible and be understanding and, yeah, and all yeah. the rest of it. And it, they, what, who we've had from through you guys have been exceptional,
yeah.
Really exceptional. So 2020 came. I'm just going to change what we're talking about now. When was the last time you saw your dad?
Ooh. March the 8th, 2020. He was in hospital. Dad had a stroke in 2011 when I started RFS, and I would spend a lot of time going up and down the M4 with two little kids, bundle them in the back, drop them off at my mother-in-law's or my mum's, and go and see Dad, and used to sit with him. And you know, Dad was amazing in the sense that he had a very severe stroke. He fell over and he wasn't found for 2 days. Mm. And he had kidney failure. You name it. And Dad was like, you know, Mr. Magoo in the sense that he had so many accidents. He was accident prone. But yeah, Dad was, I just sort of, yeah, that was really tough going down there and you know, trying to be a mum, start a business, all the stuff I was going through with the people trying to take my business off me and have my dad really unwell. So he had a lot of ill health. So March the 8th, 2020, I went down to see him, and it was really weird because I was sitting with him, it was dark, and I remember what I was wearing, and I was holding his hand strangely, and next to him was the funeral director. Dad has this dark sense of humour. He was always having a joke and a laugh and a joke, and he'd always say something really funny in a really the wrong time. And one of the things he did say is he said, "Dor, do you want to measure me up now?" This is the funeral director was next door to his bed, and you all know. And I was chatting to Dad, he was in for some heart thing, and he wasn't ill, he wasn't unwell, but I do believe that he picked up COVID because he had lots of health, you know, lung problems, COPD, and I absolutely put it down to stress, that he was so stressed in his later working life. And I held his hand, and Dad wasn't a very huggy, kissy, but we was when we were kids, but I remember kissing him on his forehead and saying, Dad, I've got to go now. And I was walking down the thing and I thought, that's the last time I'm going to see him. And then obviously lockdown happened, and it just, I moved on the phone to Dad all the time, FaceTiming him every day, and said, Dad, you know, you're isolating, it's only be a few weeks, you'll be fine. And he was, oh, I don't understand, and what's going to happen? And my sister lives quite local, so she was dropping things off for him. And we were chatting to him and we were talking. My son plays a lot of rugby, he's 12, and he was loving that. He loved the fact that he, you know, his grandson was really into rugby, so he was always phoning up, asking him what he was doing. And then I woke up in the morning, it was the 10th of April, and I just had this really weird feeling, and I tried to phone him and I couldn't get hold of him. I thought there was something wrong, and his lady that was doing care, she was actually the guy that her husband was in the Navy, and he would go around and do all the stuff. And I said, and this is when lockdown, everything had just awful was happening, I said, you need to go around there, because I think I can't get hold of him. And my sister just phoned me and said, you know, I just heard her howling down the phone. Sorry. And I can't remember what happened after that, but my children were with me. Neil wasn't there because he was at work. And my whole world fell apart. My heart was totally broken because my sort of one and only real champion, you know, the man that was always there for me along was not there. And it was just so hard. It was really hard. And then it went into sort of a, literally, it was a month of of stuff, because then the funeral director, bless him, was a family, you know, being in it from a local sort of village where everybody knows everybody. You know, I get the funeral director on the phone, and my sister, so my brother was doing, we all kind of took our roles and responsibilities on, and the funeral director was just amazing at his job, and he said, right, love, he said, we're going to have a chat about what we're going to do. And I said, okay. And he said, I said, so the funeral. And he said, love, he said, there's not going to be a funeral. And I said, you're joking. And he said, there's going to be five. We're going to have cremation. There's no hymns. There's no readings. And even like the flowers, you couldn't have flowers. And even like the coffin, and everything was taken away from you, you know. Sorry. And it was really hard, because Dad was always the one I would phone up all the time. And every time things got tough, he'd say, it's fine, just keep going, love, it's fine, keep going. Sorry, I don't usually. And anyway, so we got, the funeral day came, and my sister was amazing, because she got this, her friend had put together this amazing sort of, she had this woodland, and she put together this amazing sort of woodland flower, which just completely draped the whole coffin, and it looked so beautiful. And my brother was there, and my brother said, we're not going to go down the A40, we're going to go across the mountain. And it was like a massive detour. And the funeral director said, yeah, we'll do anything you want, you know, under the circumstances, is COVID, you know, we'll do whatever you want. We had this, Dad used to, when we were kids, used to drive us with the windows down, playing music, and we'd be going on a picnic somewhere. So we just drove around the back roads, and it was just lovely, and it was a moment to be, you know, to think about him. And we got there, and the funeral director looked at me, and he just nodded at me, and I was like, "What are you trying to say?" And he said, "You're going to have to carry him in." And so me and my brother and my sister had to carry Dad in. It was just, it felt really cruel. We couldn't, we couldn't sort of, what we couldn't do is I couldn't sit with my husband, and I couldn't even sit next to my sister. So you had to sit there on your own, social distancing, which was ridiculous at the time. And then he said a few words, a song was played, and the curtain was then, and that we had to go home to our house. We weren't allowed to go back to somebody else's house. There was no wake, there was no, and then Facebook, and I was hacked by the Chinese a few months ago, and it's probably the best thing that ever happened, because I had so many messages, and actually I had a message from you, Michael, thank you, but so many messages from people, which is lovely, but it's too much, you know, and not to have that acknowledgement. And then it's almost like people forget, they sort of forget that it's happened. And I just remember my dad was like, that he was very much around, you've just got to keep going, whatever happens, you just got to keep going. And the last thing he said to me was, keep going now, don't give up. And I just remember I got back to work, and I thought, oh, I've got to keep going. And then it all hit with work and COVID, and we lost overnight. And the frustrating thing was that it was just starting to go really well. Everything was just starting to play out, and COVID hit, and then whack, that was it. You know, I lost 95% of my work overnight. I had to make redundant, my team. And then I had to make 15 redundant. And I just hung on. I just had to dig deep. I was trying to homeschool the children, and meanwhile, everybody was on TikTok and doing, you know, silly things and talking about toilet rolls. And all I was trying to do is just hold on to my business and keep it going. And that was really tough. And Neil obviously wasn't around, because he was working. He was on sort of working on the Nightingale Builds a lot, and he was isolating at work. So I was on my own a lot. And it was a challenging time, but I do remember I had a few friends and a bit of support around me at the time, and that really helped. And my friends had such great sense of humour, you know, and just keep going, it's fine. You know, you really figured out, I remember you funny up saying, welfare check.
Yeah.
and that was great. And having friends around at the time was really, really important.
Have you had time to grieve?
Yeah.
Are you still going through it?
What? Well, we did Scatter His Ashes back in August. Sorry, it's the first time I've really kind of talked to anybody about doing it on a podcast. I know if you're listening going, oh no, how embarrassing. But
the thing is, we've all been through it in some way.
Yeah, I think so. But there's always, Dad would always see the funny side in things. He'd always see something funny, you know. And yeah, we managed to scatter his ashes in a beautiful part of Pembrokeshire, which is, and my son Harry, because he loves rugby. He signed a ball, and all the grandchildren signed a ball, and Neil, my husband, Red, Dylan Thomas, and Harry kicked the ball into the sea, and it was just, he went like that, you know, and Dad would have loved that. And Mum was there, and they're just family, and it was just lovely. It was really, and it's actually, there was something, it's quite special and unique about that, and Dad was very special and very unique. And I think looking back, I don't think, oh, poor me, how awful was it? I just look back and think how lucky we were to have such a great dad and to have so much. He'd always find the humour in any situation. And I still, to this day, coming here today, something happened and I tripped up and fell into a taxi. And I'm always, you know, seeing the funny side in things. And I think that Dad is always looking down on me and seeing that. And I think it's a really important thing to keep going, and that's what he'd want me to do. I have never looked at myself and thought, poor me, how hard is it? But I just, yeah, he was very a lovely man, and I think that's all I can do is he'd want me to keep going, really.
Well, come on, keep going. You had, and you clung on. What did you say to me before? They're not at the end, I think.
You have clung on. My team, it's almost our strapline now, is that my dad used to say to me, when you get to the end of the rope, you tie a knot and you hang on.
Mm.
And that's what I've done. And I continue to do it every day. It's relentless, you know. And I do wake up at 3 in the morning in the mild panic going, what am I doing?
Yeah.
And you know yourself what that's like, but yeah, it's.
So you have built it back, and what's the team now? How many?
So you got a team of 15, and I look at my team every day, and I'm just like, I feel so proud of them, and in every single way, they are just amazing. And every single person brings something different to the team. We have humour. We work. We get our heads down. When there's a problem, we all get on teams and we just talk about it. We get through stuff. If there's an issue, we just send an email, we deal with it, we don't back talk. But it's almost like, it is, I kept saying, it's like a bit like that film Braveheart, you know, when you're in a battle sometimes, and sometimes it does feel like a battle and it is a challenge. And we, like yesterday, I was in a meeting with AMS, and they're just brilliant, but you're constantly fighting for spouses, because it's very easy to have cheap labour. It's very easy to fit into a corporate model, but it's not very easy for a corporate model to fit into a SME model. And that's essentially what we had to do, is we had to get AMS to really open, and Virgin as well, to really be open about, right, this is how we need to work together.
It's so difficult. It's one of the most difficult things. Well, I've not been able to do it. We cannot fit into a big business model.
Mm.
Yet there is the ability really to do it, and it's frustrating.
Yeah.
And we've moved away because that's too cutthroat there. And you've done something that not many people.
It's a lot of conversations, a lot of chat. And I think, as you know, it's difficult because, and again, I think with military spouses, we learned, and say negotiate, but talk. We can talk until the cows come home. but yeah, you do definitely learn to just, I mean, and me, it was like going back to the days of working with the Olympics. They got up every morning and they showed up. They did their best. They did their best work. And that's all we do. And you can have the buy-in from the CEO and you can have the buy-in from the big company. But unless you've got senior management, it's like a sandwich effect. Unless you've got, you know, the senior management feeding in and getting it as well. And I mean, there was a situation just recently and I thought, I've got to go to Poland. I've got to sit in front of this woman and tell her I will do whatever it takes. And I have to do that sometimes. I didn't actually go to Krakow. I would have loved to have done that. I was like, God damn it, I missed out on there. But I do really, like we've had this challenge recently and I thought I've got to get through this next challenge, which is the Liquid Workforce is amazing way to get spouse into it. So the idea is that they come into our fold and we coach them, support them, mentor them, and then we put them into what we call effectively a holding bay, and then we train them to be resource specialists. And we say to spouses, look, all this is an opportunity, it's a platform for you. You're like little fledgling birds. You need to go out and spread your wings. As soon as you get in, you can go, you have the opportunity of a platform of thousands of jobs. Mm. Go for it. You know, go and get that job. And that's how it works.
What are you most proud of?
That's a good question. My family, my children, and my team. I feel really, really responsible for my team. I'm so proud of them. You know, we had a strategy day down in Abergavenny in Wales the other day, and they travelled all the way, and they slinked off somewhere, and I was, didn't think what they were doing, but they said, oh, they were working, late at night because they had been travelling all day, and I don't expect them to do that, but they really show up. And they're just a really great bunch of people. I'm so proud that we've just employed our first male spouse. Mm. He's doing really well, Chris. And so it's just a really good team, and I'm really, really proud of them.
Before we go, what was your dad's favourite song?
So my favourite song on my dad's was Debussy's Clair de Lune, and I think it says a lot about my last year of life. I've learned more about myself this last year over COVID and losing my dad than I have about anything. And it's made me, it's full of, the song is full of hope and future, but it's full of, there's disappointment, there's opportunity, but in that song is just everything. And he always used to try and play us classical music as children. I mean, oh, Dad, it's so boring. And then it's me listening to The Cure, whatever it was I was into at the time. But yeah, Dad, that's a beautiful song. It really is.
Hella, thank you so much. And we will leave it there.